Well, hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How y'all doing? Well, it's great to be back here and to see all of you on our ninth week. Three more, and I'm out of here. I always make these comments at the beginning, in case you haven't been here before, and that is, this is not a step class or how to work the steps or Joe and Charlie or anything like that. It's merely somebody who's been around a long time has some stories that may get across the principles behind the various steps, and they may be useful in your grasping what we're trying to accomplish here. And other than that, we're just here to have fun. We're also adding in some stories about the history of AA and a few other things. And so that's sort of the setup. And let me get started. There isn't much in the 70s. I made some notes about we've gone through the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and so now we're at the 70s. In 1970, they had the International Convention in Miami, which was AA's 35th year, and the theme was unity, and Bill Wilson gave his last talk. He was quite ill with emphysema, and he was scheduled to speak, and then the word was around, he's not going to be able to make it. He's not going to be able to make it. And my friend Clancy was there, and he was talking to another old-timer, older than Clancy, and Clancy was saying, well, it looks like he's just too weak to talk. And the other guy said, he'll talk. Guarantee you, he will talk. And I'll be darned at the last minute, the ambulance pulls up. And Bill gets out and gives his talk, and they took him off stage, and he went away. And Clancy said, well, how did you know? How did you know? And he said, well, in 1950, Dr. Bob got out of his deathbed and gave his last talk at the convention in Cleveland. And I knew Bill wasn't going to let that happen where he wasn't going to go give his talk. And so shortly thereafter, on January 24th, 1971, Bill passed away. And we owe a great deal to Dr. Bob and to Bill. And I just am such an admirer of Bill. And one of my greatest regrets is that my friends in Washington go up to the Bill Wilson dinner every year. And I wouldn't, they'd ask me to go, and I'd say, I don't have enough money. It probably would have cost $70 or something like that to go up. And so they'd go, and then they'd ask me the next year and the next year. And I remember my friend Hal saying, you know, he's not going to last forever, and you're going to really regret that you never met him. Ask me if I regret it. Man, I mean, that would have been such an honor. But it didn't happen. 1972, we started our archives in the central the General Service Office, and Nell Wing, who is took over as Bill's secretary, did a wonderful job of setting up wonderful archives. And she's passed away, but there's someone else taking her place. I understand is really a professional, and so I look forward to my next visit up there. It's really great. If you go there, be sure and look at the archives. They've got newspaper stories from all the way back to first time AA was mentioned in the newspapers. Oddly enough, on the same page was a story about somebody over in Germany that was rising up and was going to save the country. And I often thought about, there it is on the front page of the New York Times, this thing called AA and this thing called Hitler. And you talk about a good and evil appearing all at once. And the amount of good that's been done by AA is just immeasurable. The next year, Came to Believe got published. And our big book reached 1 million copies. And they had a ceremony in the White House and gave it to President Nixon, who probably should have read it. Just observing, I'm not taking his inventory. And then the 75 Living Sober was published, and that's the second biggest seller after the Big Book. It's really popular amongst AA members. 1976, the third edition came out, and in 78, 2 million Big Books. So it only took 4 years to go from 1 million to 2 million. And that, you know, it took all those years to get there. And then 1979, Ernest Kurtz came out with his wonderful history book, Not God, where he did a PhD dissertation on our fellowship, and it is one of the better analysis of the dynamics of our history. And it's well worth reading when you get to that stage where you want to get interested in history. Now, there was another story that I wanted to talk about tonight, and then I'll get to the ninth step. And I'll tell you some stories. When I was in the Marine Corps many years ago, we had I was on a presentation team that traveled around the country and even the world giving a overview of the Marine Corps and how it would be in the future. And so they had a hypothetical situation. Oddly enough, way back then it was set in the Middle East. And Huntley Brinkley introduced it, and it was, you know, the general was the head of it, and then we went through, and it showed all of the weapons, the fighter planes, the tanks, the artillery, the communications, the supply, and it was just this whole thing with slides and movies. It took about 8 hours to show the enormity of the operation with the Navy ships and all of that. And at the end of the show, the general would come out and he would say, "Ladies and gentlemen, all of the things you've seen, all of this only serves one purpose." And then they'd flash a slide of a Marine infantry, E1 or E2, with a rifle. And he would say, "To make his job easier." That's the whole point. That's what all the supply line, everything was to make his job easier, because that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where everything gets done. And the reason I tell that is to make an analogy to Alcoholics Anonymous. That in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have, as we just talked about, the General Service Office, General Service Conference, we have international activities, we have publications and pamphlets, we have intergroup offices, we have, I don't know, a million or 200,000 groups, I'm losing track of that, and we're in over 100 countries. So we have this enormous activity known as AA, the big mothership known as Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you think about it, all of that is just there to facilitate and enable one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. That's where it happens. That is why AA works. It is all the rest of it just supports that. Our clubs, our dances, all of that just supports that. And the reason I bring that up is that it is absolutely essential to understand what the process of identification is. Because identification is how a new alcoholic connects to AA in a way that glues them in with sufficient bonding effect so that they're safe from alcohol. And when you think about it, if you are going to go see a therapist about your alcoholism, you go in the office and the therapist says, well, tell me all about you. Tell me all about you. But when AAs go on a 12-step call to a new person, they go, let us tell you all about us. It's exactly the opposite. And we just sit there and tell our entire story. And sometimes we'll bring two people. And two people will tell their entire story. And then, when I got sober, we went to just speaker meetings for at least 3 months before we went to a discussion meeting so that we would hear stories so that we could identify. And finally, the old saying was, somebody told my story. And they stood up there and they just, well, they hid the vodka in the toilet and they did this and they, my God, that's exactly the same, so that I felt this 100% connection with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and with the person that was going to help me. And as a sponsor, I also make the same bonding with the new alcoholic. And I can remember the first time I went on a 12-step call for a periodic. And he told me that sometimes he stayed sober for 2 months before he drank again. And I went, I don't know anything about that. I don't know what he's talking about. So I went back to my sponsor and he says, well, we got a couple of periodics in the group, so we're going to help. They're going to go with you the next time, and then there'll be this connection that is made. So I'm just telling you that I had this feeling that I was the wrong person to talk to, a periodic, because we weren't exactly the same. And it's that exact sameness that creates the bond that keeps us sober when Dr. Alcohol comes knocking on the door. And so that's a very important thing. And back then, 50% of the people who came to AA never drank again. And 75% would slip around a little bit and then they would never drink again. And of the other 25%, some of those made it. I think I had 4 months before I heard about a slip. You know what I mean? I said, what's that? Somebody out in Manassas. I said, what is that? And my sponsor said, you're not allowed to have one. So I got faked into thinking that there were classes of people, those allowed to have one and those that weren't. And anytime I thought about having a drink, I went, oh, I'm not allowed. Gee whiz, that's... I got sober with the... two other guys, we called ourselves the class of 64, and I'm the only one left. I just was up for a memorial service. But all three of us never took a drink. Now, I'm just laying the groundwork here. And I'll make this point. Back then, everyone was dual addicted. All of the meetings were smoking meetings. All of them. And smoking set up a craving that you could hardly get through the meeting. I mean, it's just was such a thing. You had to get money, you have to steal cigarettes if you didn't have one. And we knew it was killing us. It killed a whole bunch of AA, still does. Killed Bill Wilson. It's a fatal addiction. But no one tried to use AA to stop smoking. We didn't identify ourselves as alcoholics and nicotine addicts and then have someone who's a alcoholic non-smoker sponsoring an alcoholic smoker so that they could feel different from one another. It wasn't brought into the equation. We used AA principles to stop smoking, but outside of AA. In other words, everything was kept just alcohol. Now, I come up with the analogy of our space shuttle. which is kind of like the big mothership of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the thing that's been making the headlines over the past few years are the tiles that are coming off. And those tiles are put on there to protect it from temperatures from minus 1,000 up to plus 3,000, mostly during reentry, when the stress is the greatest. And there's great consternation when that happens, because if enough of them come off, it could endanger the whole ship. So when it happens, they go to the manufacturer and they really raise hell. They said, "You didn't bond this; they weren't put on right. The bonding was not adequate to withstand the turmoil of the reentry." And the manufacturer has to go along with that. He doesn't say, "No, it wasn't that. The Earth's atmosphere has changed. And there's more friction in the atmosphere now, and that's what's causing them to go off." No, if the bonding wasn't tight enough. And so we hear a lot about, well, today's world, addiction is different than it used to be. And that's why the percentage is dropping. And that's why so many people, the percentages aren't as high. And so we take that into account and we just go, well, must be something else. But I'll submit to you that it is the bonding to this program that is going to protect each one of us during reentry. When the rubber meets the road, am I going to be held tight enough to not go flying off into alcoholism space out there? And so I just am bringing that up as a thought on that. And if you want to find out what's been written about it, I would suggest something that Bill Wilson wrote, which is called Problems Other Than Alcohol. And he thought, I mean, back then they had pill addicts, there's lots of drug problems. And so he thought carefully about what AA should do about all these things. And he wrote this pamphlet. And as you know, the decision was made to make AA itself exclusive and to give authorization to anybody with a different type of problem permission to use AA's 12 steps. And we have 100 other problems, over 100, that are using the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there is absolutely no problem if five or six alcoholic drug addicts wanted to form a group of alcoholic drug addicts. It just wouldn't be an AA meeting. It'd be the same steps. It would be the same everything. But when they met, they would be bonding perfectly. And so we're back to our situation. And I'll give you one final analogy. When you have a magnifying glass, you can use it to read small print. But you can also use it to start a fire. You can use the power of the sun to actually cause small twigs and leaves to ignite and start a fire. And I'm going to call that fire a spiritual awakening. Now, that's done by taking the magnifying glass and bringing the circle of light down to a pinpoint, down to the tiniest possible spot. And then, boom, it would be possible to move the magnifying glass in a little bit and have a spot about an inch or an inch and a half in diameter, which would make the ground right there much warmer than it was. It would be kind of warm and fuzzy. And it would be more inclusive. You could include more of the ground getting warm. And we can do the same thing. We can open the doors wider and wider and have a bigger segment of the population feel wonderfully warm, welcome, and fuzzy, and hugs, and dances, and all of the wonderful things. But when reentry takes place, warm and fuzzy won't cut it. It's just not going to work. We're going to go pew. And so I just want to make a pitch for this particular topic. I imagine an AA dance. And I imagine people having the most wonderful time. And for purposes of my story, I got a lady named Mary. She's got 8 months. She's never felt happier in her life. Being in this fellowship has made her appreciate life like she's never appreciated it before. And she has new friends. And she just has a new purpose and feels just wonderful about herself. No intention of drinking. She's just at the dance. And a black car pulls up like the Batmobile. And a guy gets out. And we're nervous already as he gets out of the car. You know, he's kind of tall, dark, mysterious, with a cape. And he comes into the dance, and you can see everybody at the dance kind of go, whoa, who is that? And he looks at his dance card and goes right over to Mary. Taps her on the shoulder, and she turns around, and he said, "Hi, my name is John Barleycorn. May I cut in?" And there's a kind of a warning feeling in her gut. But she says, "Sure." And they dance a couple dances. And he says, "Why don't we get out of here and go really have some fun?" And she drives off in his car. And maybe 6 months later, even 6 years later, the car pulls back up and she's dropped on the road, half dead. There wasn't any protection when the disease knocks. And the difference when the bonding is complete and we've been led to an awakening, the same situation happens and the same car pulls up and the same Barleycorn comes over with the dance card with Mary's name on it. He taps her on the shoulder. She turns around. And John Barleycorn sees God standing there and says, "Oh, never mind," and leaves. And she's completely unaware that there was ever any danger or of what could have possibly happened. She was dancing in a position of neutrality. Dancing in a position of neutrality. That car could pull up 50 times a night. And she'd just stay there dancing, having a wonderful time. And so I just offered up to think about. Because I'm old. I'm not, AA's done well for 72 years, and it's done well by me for 42 years, but you guys are going to be around a lot longer than that. And I'm just asking you to think about this mothership and how tight the tiles are, because I was up in Maine a couple of weeks ago and I gave a modified version of this little pitch. And afterwards, there were several irate people who came up to read me the riot act. And one of them was a young lady who said I'd ruined her life. She said, I joined OA some time ago, and it didn't work at all. So I went to AA. I went to an AA group. I asked them to have a group conscience that I could become a full-fledged member, and they agreed. And now I can sponsor alcoholics. And I said, well, we're really not discussing the fifth tradition here, primary purpose. We're now discussing the fourth tradition, which each group is autonomous. And that means that any AA group can do something really stupid. just like the Richmond group did when they served booze at meetings. It just didn't last very long, and it didn't work. I was just working with a new guy. He's not here tonight. And we spent a lot of time on the first step and identification until I felt that I absolutely was connected with him and he was connected with me. And then I said, okay, now we're ready to go through the rest of the steps for the spiritual awakening. And he said, you really think it'll happen? And I said, well, let me put it this way. I'm as sure that it'll happen as I am when I put water in the freezer that it'll turn into ice. I can't guarantee it, but I'm pretty damn sure it's going to turn into ice. And so I leave you with that thought. It's your mothership, and you're going to be the ones 30 years from now, and maybe the whole fellowship will be going through a turmoil. I don't know. Some kind of inner disputes or getting in trouble. The Washington Post just had a big story about an AA group in Washington that really did some bad stuff. And as the mothership goes through some kind of a major challenge, will the individual tiles stay on? That's all I'm asking. Will they stay on? Will they be bonded tight enough, like we're talking about, or not? So anyway, thanks for letting me get that little thing out of the way, and I will never bring it up again, ever, ever, ever. So we'll move over to what we've been talking about in our spiritual principles, in our 12 steps. And as you know, if you've been coming here, for sake of illustration, we've been comparing ourselves to slide projectors. I don't know where that came from, but... And we decided that as slide projectors, we projected up on a screen, which was the real world, and then the stuff we saw up there became disturbing, unfair, caused us resentments, made us angry, and we went up to the screen and tried to change things. That was our pattern before we got here. We went out in the world, we looked out there, we saw what needed to be changed, and then we went out and tried to change it. And we got more resentful, more frustrated, and more drunk. And then we came into AA and they said, stop trying to fix that. That's not the cause of the problem. The problem is in the projection booth. The problem is in the stuff you're projecting up there. If we fix what's in here, you're going to love what you see up there. And we talked about the fact that these slides that are causing all these problems are made by thinking. That's how you manufacture slides. Well, I got to put a slide together. Let me think for a moment. Wow, that sucks. This is no good. I don't like him. Put it on there. Boom. Look at that. Wow. There's a terrible situation up there, and now I feel bad about it. Now I can react emotionally to what I just saw up there, which I created by thinking about it. And so in AA, we have a saying that problems are of our own making, and that's how we make them. I just swear that if something's bothering you, there ought to be a law that you're not allowed to think about it. Anything else you want, but do not think about it. Because in reality, thinking about a problem is like pouring gasoline on it. It's going to get bigger and bigger and much more disturbing, whereas if you had ignored it, it probably would have burned out of its own lack of fuel. But it's very hard for us to believe that. And so we just talk about it. And I think the last time I was saying, I said, you know, your thinking's not reliable. It's, remember, somebody, you've heard that if you're new. Your thinking's just not reliable. It's just not. You really shouldn't trust it. You really shouldn't. So what do you think about that? I don't know. I think I'll have to think about that one and see what, you see what I mean? In other words, no matter what it is, our ego tells us that the answer is to think about it. And then we come in here and we're getting closer and closer to the not thinking, to just meditating, praying, and living, and just go through life and not think about it, not react to it, not editorialize on it. That is so hard for us to do, for human beings, to not see someone and then editorialize on them. Well, look at that guy. What kind of a stupid shirt is that? What is that? Why can't we just go, well, there's him, and there's her, and there's him. Well, we got some little editorial comment about everything. About the room we're in, about the coffee, about whatever it is. And then we play those in our head and drive ourselves crazy. And so this exercise of the 12 steps is to find out what all these problems are and to have our higher power remove them. And we've been through the inventory and the sharing with our sponsor, and then becoming entirely willing to have these slides removed. And we get into what looks like just sort of an afterthought, and that is to go back and take a look at the past and see what kind of harm we may have done others. And we have no idea that this is where the major, major changes are made in what we're going to see up on the screen. Because we're going to go into the booth and start looking at all the slides that we have where there was a conflict with someone else, which is almost all the slides. We got a few resentments with the IRS and the government or something like that, but almost everything else has to do with people. Only this time, instead of very carefully keeping track of what they did to us, we're going to use the magic eraser of forgiveness, and we're only going to focus on what harm could I have done them? How did I cause their day to be less pleasant as a result of me coming by? And before we get here, Phil writes in the big book that we have the power to bring out the worst in people. That's our specialty. Never saw that guy misbehave before? Watch this. Are you telling me that man never lost his temper before he met me? Isn't that amazing what I can do? So we are creating quite a world to live in, because the world is composed of other people and we're bringing out the worst in them. It's no wonder we drink. It's such a rotten world. But until we get the slide projector and open it, we don't realize we're putting it together in here. Da, da, da. Well, I'm going to make a crappy day for me. Just a second. Now watch this. Oh, my God, that's awful. I think I'll have a drink. We think that it's all happening out there, that the problems and the things that are bothering us and everything is up there. It's like we're playing a joke on ourselves. It's like our ego is the practical joker and we're the butt of the joke. It's just the same as if he just pulled the rug out from under me. And then I know I'm doing it, but I do it anyway. So now we start this amends process. And it is a very powerful eraser of the past events. It is one of the hardest things for the human ego to do, to admit that it's wrong, and to go not knowing what's going to happen and deal with things that we've been carrying around They wouldn't be on our list if we weren't carrying them around. This list of harm we did others doesn't come from letters from people going, add me to the list. We're already carrying it. We carry it around day and night, the harm we've done others. Because there's part of us that doesn't want to harm people. And that's the part we want to get to know. But how do we know what's going to happen when we go make these amends? And that's when Bill writes, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And this is a huge risk. I remember that story about the man who had robbed the 10 homes and told his sponsor he didn't want to go there. And he said, all right, let's try staying sober without going there. And a few years went by, and finally he said, I can't take it anymore. I got to go see all those people whose homes I broke into. And maybe you've heard this story, but he went there. The sponsor told the story. And the sponsor went with him. They went at 6 o'clock at night. He pulled up and he coached them to say, I'm the man who broke into your house 5 years ago and took a whole bunch of your stuff. I'll be glad to wait here if you want to call the cops, but I'm in AA, I'm a sober alcoholic now, and I'm trying to make amends. Now, those people could have called the cops. He could have gone right to jail, but he had to do that in order to stay sober, because his mind would not allow him the peace until he had done it. And he tried it for a couple of years. And the story goes that each one of them did not call the cops. Some of them just said, I'm so glad you came back to tell me who it was that I'm going to just let it go. Other people said, well, I'd like some financial reimbursement, $500. And he'd say, well, I can pay $25 a week. And he made all the settlements till he got to the last house. And the lady answered the door and he told her what the situation was. And then he said, I'd like to make amends. And she said, you already did. And he didn't understand what she was saying. And so she got her husband and said, tell my husband what you just told me. And so he told him.